If you've ever been on a really good team, it's just something you know.
So, how do we start?
Hi, this is Aga and Łukasz, and this is Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
And much more.
Werner is at the conference today, so instead of him, my husband Łukasz decided to help me to talk to our really good friend, Peter Abrahamsen, who spent 28 years in the uniform in the Navy, and then at some point decided that it would be very interesting to see whether the stuff that he learned there can be applicable to the outside world. Right now, he's helping governmental institution in Norway to create leadership that is actually prone to change.
It's a bit of everything, in fact. So it's everything from process improvement to kind of thinking through leadership, pretty much improvements all around the board.
Mm-hmm. Peter, thank you for being here. I'm super curious what you're going to tell us.
Absolutely delighted and glad to be here, yeah.
Okay, so you said that you were on the armed force for 28 years and you wanted to see what things could work outside that worked inside. What were the things that you wanted to bring to the outside world?
Doing military training, you get taught a lot of stuff and you take lots of it for granted. I mean, just think about in leadership. You're trained from very early on how to think, how to act, what to do. And a lot of this is kind of tacit knowledge that is passed down from one generation to the next. And then you sit on the inside of the fence and you look at the outside, as we would say, and you see things that are going on the outside and you see what they call leadership. And it's not always one-to-one. Things look a little bit different. So I was pretty much just wondering, okay, the things that we learn on the inside of the fence, can they be in fact used and applicated on the outside of the fence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What works, what doesn't?
Well, the fun thing was that I, at least when I left the armed forces, thought I maybe didn't know enough. There are no doubt big holes in what I know. It turned out a lot of the things I really took for granted were not very well known on the outside of the fence. There's a whole lot within leadership that is very basic knowledge within the armed forces that I feel is not very known on the outside.
What are the most important ones?
The most important ones, I think, is the importance of understanding when to use what kind of leadership. We were trained to think in what we called situational leadership, which is pretty much depending on what kind of context you are in, you will use a different way of leading. One of the fun things about the armed forces is I think the entire kind of unit you are in, they're all trained to think pretty similar. So everybody knows what's going on. This is also one of the parts I felt was missing on the outside. Very few people have formal leadership training. They will have leadership experience through on the job and whatever. But I don't think they're really drilled in it and pushed to the limits. Because don't forget, in the armed forces, most of your time is used training, drilling. So it gives you an enormous advantage. You can try out different ways of doing things many, many, many times before you have to use it in real life.
It's actually opposite to what's going on in the companies and in the outside world, where you sort of get a little bit of training and then you have to keep on applying it day in, day out.
Yeah.
Or you're promoted to a manager even if you never wanted to because you are a super expert.
And I also think this, I mean, the one thing is from the leadership level. The next one I would think that was very different in the armed forces, but that has a connection to this, is the concept of team. And I must say, I am a Navy officer, so of course, I mean, you will find differences in the different armed forces around the world, but also within the different branches of the armed forces. But also, again, teams. I find that having the luxury of training a team, being together, and in fact preparing before you have to start doing something, kind of builds very good teams. What I see on the outside is that you put together teams, and then they start working immediately, and somehow people are confused or even surprised by the fact that these teams don't work efficiently from day one. They don't have a chance because they haven't been through all the different processes they have to enable to be a well-working team. They don't know each other well enough. They can't see each other's strengths and weaknesses. They don't know how to support each other and that kind of thing. And I think that's maybe also, again, like I say, big difference between the world I came from and the world I'm in now.
Hmm. How are the teams trained in the Navy?
I think one of the things is, of course, that you put together people and then you start training. That is, they don't have to really meet reality from day one. So they get time to know each other. They get to know each other's strengths, weaknesses. This putting people together and letting them live together very, very closely, that does something with you. You can't hide. You have to be a lot more open and show yourself. And I think that's the kind of basis you need to start building trust, real trust. Or in the case of trust, maybe even respect and respect for each other's both strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned it, that you need trust to depend on one another. The closest I have seen to forming teams in a big organization is going for beer before the project starts. But I think this is just for lowering the kind of a communication barrier, just to be able to enable basically this common work, understanding and communication and whatnot. And I have yet to see, you know, a proper forming of a team before the real work starts.
And I think the first step could be a beer or whatever you do, kind of the introductions and get to know each other. But I think the team really starts forming as a team when you understand that you can help others and you need help. Mm-hmm. You can't get through everything alone. So just accepting that as a fact, and I don't think that happens over a couple of beers in the evening. This is something you have to go through. You have to sweat and live and really meet hardship to see that the other person next to you will in fact support you, and you in fact are also able to support somebody else when the going gets tough.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say, I think it's a good start, but I'm not quite sure that gets you all the way. You have to in fact go through some sort of hardship to really get to know somebody or really understand them, mm-hmm. and understand the qualities you need both to support but also in fact be helped by somebody.
So you said that you are bringing these things to the outside world. How do you train your teams these days so they become those teams that have a chance to function?
I can't do what we would have done in the armed forces. I can't take them out and take them out for a week and keep them there without sleep or food and stuff like that and really find out
who they
are. I could try, yeah. And I mean, there are companies now delivering those kinds of gatherings or happenings in team building or whatever. I'm not quite sure it's exactly the same thing, but okay. No, so what can you do if you can't do that? Well, one of the things at least I try to do is have a lot of discussions, try and open up and find out where people really are, what they think, what they mean, beyond the pleasantry level. I also try to explain my findings on use of energy and support, understanding each other's roles. Let me begin with the first one, this with energy. One of the things you will very quickly learn in the armed forces is that if you're trying to hide something, it can be an emotion, a feeling, whatever, something you're worried about, that eats up energy you need for something else. And mostly this is totally unnecessary. Because if you're in a group where you're trying to understand each other, I think this openness kind of gives you two things. The one thing is being open gives a possibility for someone else to trust you because you're delivering. And the other one is you can build down your barriers. You don't have to be scared about things. So a simple one is, for example, being scared of not being able to do something or not be able to do something well. I can either bottle that up and try to hide the fact that I'm not very good at something, or I can tell my team, you know what, I'm not very good at this. And then somebody else can raise their hand and say, well, you know what, I'm good at that, so I'll do that, but I'm bad at this. And then you have this sort of kind of finding out what the different members of the team in fact can do.
What happens definitely in business, I guess much more in that in the military, that I suspect that one of the ingredients that is required for the team to form, they need a common goal. And in the military, I guess that's easier to get. In the worst case, it's survival, whatever, you know, the mission. And in business, I've seen a good share of what were called dysfunctional teams. And the one that I'm thinking about, it's a group of individuals put together on paper. They have a business goal together. They have to deliver something, but they don't really identify with that common goal.
You could, of course, use a lot of time trying to define the explicit goal or whatever. I think maybe one of the other things that you will see in military teams is that their goal is to function per se. So they don't need some kind of defined goal to be able to function and be a well-functioning team. They want to function as well as possible. But what they do need to do to be able to focus their energy when given a mission is to have the intent. Why are we doing what we're doing? And then they can solve it. But I think the focus will be a lot more on how to be a well-functioning team, a well-functioning group. That is a goal in itself, rather than making some other exterior goal I'm trying to strive towards. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I can use a team to solve mission X and Y. They don't need just one mission. Of course, in the military context, a lot of this has to do with some of the form of friction or adversary. But I think it's a lot more about making a good team and feeling that they're competent at what they're doing. Drilling and making sure they can do things. I mentioned this about the training. You do a whole lot of training before you get into action, which is very, very different from civilian life. And all this training, all this drill, you're trying to perfect. Not towards one scenario, but towards a variety of scenarios. The whole thing is all about getting better and better and better at what you're doing. And at some point in time, you think, okay, now we're good enough to fly, and then you go out and do what you do.
In business, all the theorists and practitioners that I have met, they turn it around. They say you need a goal for people to kind of gel around at least a direction or a goal. And you say in the military, the forming of a team is not a means to an end, it's an end. I don't know what to do with this, but this is an interesting
insight. Yeah. So does it happen that you meet in the military teams that do not function?
Definitely. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no guarantee that a team will function.
Mm-hmm. What happens then?
Well, then you can either try and push them forward. I mean, in many cases, and again, especially when you're younger, when you're in the military, you're meeting a new system, things will not necessarily work. So sometimes you, in fact, want to push that through until things work. So that people understand that if they can put themselves aside for a group, all of a sudden the group will start working. So you go through all the normal phases. I mean, there's no difference there than civilian life. You have the forming, norming, storming, and performing levels, okay. But you do sometimes end up with groups that will not function. And, of course, there's a luxury. You can pick them apart and put them together again, and you can try something else. If you do have a good working team, of course, you try not to disband it. You try to keep it together as long as you can, because that will be very functional. It's efficient. But at some point in time, you might have to reconfigure. I mean, people come and people go. And every time you have a team that's built up, that's pretty good. If you change just one of the members, all of a sudden you get a totally new constellation in the group. And then you maybe have to start over again. So these are pretty difficult things. Mm-hmm. But I think there again, the military, because they do this a lot, they have many, many iterations of it, become pretty good at it, I think.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide when it is reasonable to dissolve a non-functional team? Because like, this is the problem in business, that you have a non-functional team and sort of hope that things will change. So how do you decide that?
I don't know if there's an easy answer to that. How do you decide that? Because like I say, in some cases you want to push things through until people start working together. I'll get back to what I started with, situational leadership. It depends. Do I have the time to let the team start functioning? Or am I pushed on time? If I'm pushed on time, I might want to try changing things quicker. I might want to try to identify who are the blockers in the team and take them out and see what happens. But again, like I say, even if I disband a team and I try putting together a new team, there's no guarantee the new team will function any better than the old team. So I'm taking a risk here. So it is a tricky question. So in general, I'd say, you know, if you put a group of people together and they have the right training, the right competences, it's pretty much up to the leading officer to try and make the team work and work as efficiently as possible.
You alluded at the thing that we talked about earlier, which is ego. Because I think that in a business situation, teams, especially expert teams, they are put together and there's like a lot of egos there. Like people think like I'm here so special and that's why I'm in the team and therefore the team should function the way I want it. In the military, it might be a different thing because you are put there for your function rather than for a specialty. But I'm sure that there are the situations when ego is being placed there and like battling its way in the team. So how do you deal with that?
You train a team to be a unit. And that is, you place a unit above the single person. And you try to drill that into people so they understand this. That's go back to this kind of like being there for the team, not being there for yourself. But you can also, you can end up in situations where you have people with big egos. That can go both ways. If they have a big ego, but they're very good at getting the team to work alongside with them, the team accepts the roles, that can be a pretty well-functioning team. So there's not necessarily a drawback in that. Unless somebody, of course, obviously then oversteps his boundaries and thinks that he is more important than the next level of the organization, which would most probably not be good. Mm-hmm. The ego thing, it can be a plus and it can be a minus. In the armed forces, you have two very clearly defined levels of who gets to say what. You, of course, have the rank and order. Now I feel I'm lucky because I'm from the Navy. Rank and order only goes so far. Then you have the second level, which is the kind of personality and the knowledge the different team workers have. And a good officer, in my view, would be able to put his ego aside and acknowledge sometimes that some of the people on the team are better equipped and more able to solve some of the problems the officer we put to solve. So just be able to obviously be both, you know, put his ego up front and sometimes be the leader figure and tell the team what he wants to do, how he wants to shape it, how he wants his team to be. And the next moment, maybe even put his ego aside and say, you know what, you're best at this comms thing. You do the comms thing. I'll do my thing. And just accept each other's roles. So I don't know, ego, it's a difficult concept. It would be very, very bad if you had a team without any egos. So I think you just have to have acceptance for each other's egos and give it a bit of space. Else we'll be very, very bland, I think.
How do you do this? How do you leave space for egos?
How do you leave space for egos? I think it comes down to this trust and respecting. Start opening up and start accepting each other for who we are. Understanding that you can't do everything. Situations where you know you maybe don't have the know-how. You're grown up enough to say that, you know what, okay, here somebody else can do better than I can do. Let them take over the show. And we get back to a situation that I'm maybe more adept to, and then I can take over again. But I don't know if there's any easy answer to this. It's kind of something I think you feel, you understand. If you've ever been in a really good team, it's just something you know. The same way if you're in a really bad team, you also know that. But then you have to start working. Okay, what can I do to make this team better? What's my role in the team? How can I play it better?
Actually, to an extent, it sounds to me that the military can be easier with team formation because the goal there is to be true to who you are. In business, often people put the masks on and they pretend to be someone else. So they are not really honest with who they are. And therefore, I think that a lot of friction that happens in the business environment stems from this particular fact.
I mentioned this thing about hiding or conserving energy. By hiding, in fact, not conserving energy, but using energy. So I think if you're in an environment where you have to hide who you are, your strengths, your weaknesses, really who you are as a person, a lot of energy is being spent on something else than what the team really needs. I do think it's natural at the same time, because I mean, you go into an environment and if you're not trained together, if you don't have the time up front to get to know each other, you will start a project and everybody will be very intent on delivering and you will have all these deadlines, stuff like that. And you don't really know who knows what. And you get off to a wrong start from the very beginning. If you're lucky and the team delivers from day one, they get this good feeling and they're all fuzzy hubby and they think, yeah, we have a super team here. Take them out of the good setting they're on and put them into something more complex. And all of a sudden the team collapses like a card house. It's because they don't have the basis. They don't have the experience with, in fact, really muddling through, even though it's difficult, not always winning. Yeah,
you mentioned another thing that is like super important, I think, that in business, often people strive to win at all costs. It's different in the military, am I right?
I wouldn't say different. I can tell you this, it's pretty competitive. That's part of the game, at least it was for me, trying to be the best. I would put it this way. I think there's a high acceptance for all the team members to try and be the best they can be. Because if I become very good, my mate has to become very good, and we kind of push each other. But it's an open, nice competition. When we do get missions, you want to solve the mission. You want to be best at that, no doubt about it. The competition, but also the camaraderie in the competition, is kind of like a positive aspect. I think what you will see sometimes is the following. I've seen this both on the outside and on the inside of the armed forces. You can end up with people that don't share. I have a different philosophy. I like to share. If I learn something that I think is very important, very good, if I teach that to somebody else, point one, they get better. Point two, they lift the bar. I have to become even better. I could, of course, done it the other way around. I could have said, you know, this is my specialty. I'm not going to teach it to anybody. I'm going to keep it. This is my secret. This is what keeps me floating. That is, for me, unfair kind of competition, because it doesn't make everybody better. It just makes me shine.
A practical topic that is often a question in business, at least, probably in military is also not that obvious, is how much you want to specialize, which is connected to knowing the secret sauce. So how much you want to preserve the specialization of a specific people so they are becoming really great at their function, in balance with sharing this a little bit, because if someone gets sick, you know, something happens in the military, it could be even worse, then you are stuck without a certain function. There is probably a balance to be found there.
When you start training the armed forces, everybody is given pretty much the same kind of basis training. So there you have the broad understanding of the system as such. And then you start your specialization. I think maybe also one of the other pluses in the armed forces is the following. When you start, you get to see all the different parts kind of working together at a low level. You understand everything from what it's like being a soldier to working in the kitchen to being a driver or whatever. Then you go up a level and you become an officer and you start working with a unit. You start seeing all the pieces working together. You understand the different parts. You get a very, very good knowledge of how the entire system works. So you work yourself from the bottom up. That means when you get to the top, and you maybe have, in fact, been through a specialized training, you still understand the different parts and what they mean to each other. I mean, you won't find an officer who doesn't understand the concept of logistics and the importance for, in fact, being able to do what you do. Or for that case, I mean, simple things like what might be perceived as simple things, kitchen, food, cleaning, hygiene, all these things are very, very, very important. And you understand that because you've been through the entire system.
If I take it on a smaller scale, and I know in military you distinguish between teams and crews, in business we don't. So for a moment, I will phrase it in business terms. Then you have a team of specialists on purpose because that's required, right? Like a crew on a boat.
Yeah.
And then you have a guy who specializes in, I don't know, testing. Another guy is a specialist in some sort of like analysis, for example, which is a trade on its own. And you have to put, I guess in military terms, a crew together. So a number of specialists in different areas that they together, they can deliver the whole, the product, project, whatever. How would you look at the balance of the specialization versus breaking down this specialist silos or expert silos a little bit?
I guess the optimum would, of course, be that everybody had in-depth knowledge in all areas. But, you know, that's not possible.
We know that's impossible. Okay, yeah. So what's next?
So how much effort do you put in to give the general basis and understanding? It's, again, a difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the more you know about the different areas of expertise, the easier it is for you, I think, to both understand what's going on, but in many cases, in fact, understand what you have to do to make another specialist very good. There's a Norwegian former football coach called Nils Arne Eggen. He wrote a book called The Good Foot Theory. And I think what he wrote was things that I experienced in the military. What he wrote was that you're never going to be good at everything, but you have to understand what you're good at and what you're less good at. But you also have to know the same about your teammates. If you want somebody to really be good at what they do, you have to know what you have to do to help them. What do they need to be able to do their job well? At the same time, if you know what they're weak at, you can in fact cover for some of those weaknesses. Nils Arne Eggen, like I said, was a football trainer. He trained Rosenborg, one of the few Norwegian teams that kind of went out there and did something in the European scale. He was very clear on this. He was not going to try and make his forwards very good defensive players. That was a waste of time. What they were good at was being forwards. But the forwards had to understand the defense's job and the other way around, or else they wouldn't be able to play together as a team and, in fact, what he would call play each other good. That's what he called the good foot theory. You know, understand what you have to do to make somebody else good. So I think that's a bit of it. So how deep do you go into the different levels and in your broad kind of knowledge base? I would say far enough so that you understand what the strengths and weaknesses of the specialists are in the different areas.
This is a challenge for the design teams often, because when you have a design team, the designers are good at designing and maybe doing research. When they go to the conversations with business, they don't understand what business wants, and business doesn't understand why designers are stubborn on the things that they are stubborn on. The same happens with developers. Like, designers come with certain ideas and developers think, okay, like, but this is complicated, so like, we can have a shortcut there. And they get totally annoyed with the designers because they are stubborn with their way of thinking. And it might come indeed from the fact that neither of these three groups truly understands what the job of the other person is. And that's why there's like so much friction and so much tension there. On the other hand, you say that friction and tension is not bad.
Friction and tension are bad. I mean, just think about it. The only reason that the world is moving forward in some other contexts is that we're not completely satisfied with the status quo. So we continuously kind of challenge the existing systems and try to implement better systems. And every time that is, in fact, a kind of friction. There will be people trying to keep the system as it is. There will be different opinions on what the next best system is. And out of all of this, I think you get a good environment for innovation. It's friction. And if you can see it as friction, things become a lot easier too. Especially if you can start understanding the reasons for the friction. Because there are, of course, cases also when friction is far from constructive, where in fact it's just very deconstructive or very demoralizing.
Could you give an example?
An example of something constructive nature, I would say, are two subject matter experts discussing something openly and honestly, and both of them with their background, maybe even obviously they can have two different ways into the same problem, but then listening to each other and understanding and maybe drawing the synergies out of what they know in both areas instead of beating down. A deconstructive one would be where they not listening to each other, in fact trying to kind of beat the other one down and get their way, which would in many cases be kind of a loss of possibilities and opportunities.
Does it mean that as civilians we are not really trained in having those constructive conversations?
Oh, don't misunderstand me. There are lots of civilians who do this very, very well. Lots of them. There are very, very many good people out there. The one thing I'm really missing is the kind of time to play and train together, because that gives you a different basis. So I think, if anything, what could the civilian world do out there? Maybe not always demand that a team is fully engaged in delivering. They need time to play around and get to know each other, maybe even learn new ways of thinking about both problems and each other, so that when they then next time are put into a position where they have to solve a problem, have a head start, can solve things faster, avoid unnecessary interpersonal conflicts, for example.
If you were to estimate roughly how long would you need to train the team for it to perform significantly better than if they started fresh?
Normally in the armed forces you start doing this kind of training with conscripts or younger officers. So they're pretty young. They are easy to form. But if you give me a group of people, normally what we will see is that they can be pretty well bound together after 4 to 6 weeks. What happens if you do this on more experienced, older guys? Well, there's no doubt about it. When you get older, you start getting habits. They're difficult to break. You will bring in maybe more ego. So it might take longer time. But if you have the basic training and that's kept alive over time, I think it's very easy to go right into that kind of modus. You know what's going on, and therefore it's easier to adapt and find the we instead of the I.
So let me rephrase that. I'm fishing here for some hints for business people. So suppose I'm starting a new project, and I have a group of, say, I don't know, 10 people. And I know I will need them to perform together for a year, at least. I know it's going to be important to me, important for my business. I'm willing to put up some investment, like pay them for their time while they won't be delivering. And I'll come to you as a specialist, try to bind them together so when they start the real work, they're going to work better than if we started today. How much time do you need?
Can I turn the question around and I'll ask you the following? You work with a lot of knowledge workers. How much time do you expect them to use in a week to refresh and renew knowledge?
All available time for exploiting knowledge. That's, of course, too much. What I see business is doing, especially things like banks and telecoms, they load people 100%. They don't know the theory of queues. They don't know it makes things slower. So that's why I'm on purpose phrasing the question, and I'm going to reverse it back to you. But I'm going to add one restriction. What is the shortest time you think you could have with this group of 10 people that would bring me a visible result?
Well, I would say the shortest time would be a 14-day period. There's no problem in going through something that lasts for a day or two or three. I mean, you'll hack it through. You'll just kind of take it. But you have to get to a point where you can't retreat, where you can't rejuvenate, where you can't reload, because that's when you start showing who you really are. And you have to get through that, I think. Think about it. The armed forces, how much do they train and how much do they in fact do? They spend most of their time training and a little bit of it doing. But when they do, they have to do. So I don't know. I think at least from what I've seen, although we of course have initiatives to kind of give people a little bit of space to rejuvenate their knowledge, to gain new insights and stuff like that, they're pretty much just degenerating because they're not using enough time on it. So you have this fantastic investment. You've employed somebody because they have all this knowledge, but the knowledge is dying every day, either because it's becoming obsolete or because they're forgetting stuff. And you have to invest to keep that knowledge and keep it fresh. In the same way, I think also with teams, you can put together a team and it'll work. You can put them into hard work and they will get going, but at some time they will tire. Okay, then you have to reinvest into them to keep them going. So I think it's pretty much just about, okay, what kind of strategy is the business following? Is it a long-term goal where they try to keep people over time? Or are they in for short-term investments? Like, use and throw away.
So how does all the sprint thinking, like agile and design sprints and stuff like that, fit into it?
Now I must admit, the entire concept of agile and sprint and whatever, we found a lot of new names of things we were already doing. I mean, you've always had systems where you have to work very intensely for a period and then you can relax, or if the period didn't stop, you keep going. I tend to find that both Agile, Scrum, and a lot of these other kind of project methodologies, they give you a framework to talk about things, but they don't really change teams. It's a way of working, but it's not the team. So I think you have to differ between those two. So if you have a good team, you can push them through a lot of sprints, or in my old world, you can push them through a lot of different missions, but at some point in time, they will tire. And you have to acknowledge that and then pull them out for a while so they can rest, rejuvenate, reload, zero their minds, and then you can put them in again. Because you do get tired. And if you get pushed too far, I think you start making mistakes. And you might not even see that yourself because you're in the middle of it. If you pull out, reflect, then you can maybe see things differently and go in with new energy.
Yeah, this is, I think, another insight that a business could take from military. The main reason in business to let the team rest is that they're indeed tired, but the argument, I'm guessing, is that they are not performing as well as they could. I don't think many people are thinking about mistakes that the team makes that leads to rework. And then, of course, it's spiral down, right? Because if I make mistakes, I have to fix them, which is more costly than not making it in the first place. And then you even less time to rest and turtles all the way down.
You can very quickly end up in a negative spiral. Yes, I do think so, yeah.
this podcast is about design, but this particular season is also about empowerment. So we are looking for nuggets of knowledge that help to empower people and teams and organizations. So if you were to think of how people, teams, and organizations could be empowered today to deliver better solutions, to deliver better work, what would it be?
I'll tell you a story in that context about at least kind of design or thinking about what would be best for people and empowerment. When we started getting female conscripts into the armed forces, and especially then when thinking about picking out people for officer training and so on, we saw that a lot of the girls were maybe not performing as well as we thought. But it was pretty natural when I started looking at the problem, why it was happening. I'll give an example. I will take a troop off and I will stress march them. Really try and push them to their outer limits. What I saw happening was that a lot of the girls, in fact, didn't cope. And I couldn't understand because, I mean, really physiology should say that they could do this pretty much the same as boys. But if you look at a uniform, if male soldier wants to work hard, he has to drink a lot and you pee a lot. That's no different for the female soldier. But what's the difference in the uniform? Well, for a guy to stop and piss, it takes him like a minute or two and he will do it and he'll be back in his unit again. The female, on the other hand, can't do that. So what happens? They stop drinking. When they start drinking, they start dehydrating. When they start dehydrating, they start taking bad decisions. And of course, then they drop out because they are perceived as less competent than the boys. It's really just a mistake. If I had redesigned their uniforms so they could drop and squat easier, they could maybe catch up the boys easily, most probably. So here, empowerment. Okay, yeah. If you see a problem like that, what do you do? How can you go about this? I think maybe in kind of empowering people to tell them what they need to be able to function well would be one of the areas I would go into. When I started as a conscript once upon a time, my weapon weighed 4.7 kilos and my rucksack weighed 12 kilos. I weighed somewhere between 70 and 80 kilos. My weaponry and carrying pack ratio was about 1 to 10, okay? Females are generally smaller. So if I give them the same weapon, the same backpack, they're carrying ratio-wise a lot more. They're doing a lot more work. It would be no problem really in the design world to design a weapon that was somewhat smaller for a female and that could shoot the same kind of ammunition. And I could maybe even adjust the equipment she had in. She doesn't need the same size sleeping bag. She's shorter. So I could maybe there design-wise make it easier for people, in fact, to do the job they're meant to do.
How did you deal with this? Like, so when you observe these things happening, obviously, I assume that these redesigns didn't happen. So how did you deal with these situations?
My job back then was to make sure that we got hold of the best brains. And what I saw was happening was that I maybe was losing some very good brains. I mean, intelligence is, as far as I know, equally divided between males and females. So if I was losing a lot of the females, I was most probably losing a lot of good brain power for a very stupid reason. I was not giving them the chance to kind of show me that they were able to push through. So what I started doing was accepting the fact that I had to give them some more leeway. So take stops, breaks, so they could do whatever they're doing, and then we'd push forward in a march, for example. And then, of course, they could stay in longer, and they could show that they had the brains, and that was what I was looking for. That was at least my kind of contribution to not being able to do anything with the uniforms.
Yeah, this is another solution, right? Yeah. Like, it doesn't always have to be the physical solution. It has to be understanding how you can solve the problem in new ways.
Yeah. And my hope is at least that when we get in more females, or I mean any diverse group, we get in different people, they can come with their needs and means, and if you empower them, because they one day will become officers and they will be in roles where they can maybe design tomorrow's uniform, and then maybe it'll be a different uniform. So I just have to get them through the first hurdles first, so they can come into a position where they in fact can, through the power they are given in a position, start changing things.
This is very much applicable to the business world as well, right? For women to become empowered in the business world, they need to behave a similar way as men. So there's the need for empowerment necessary at the beginning to help them add their way of thinking and their way of acting and their ways of behaving in order to enrich the whole system rather than to change it. Because I don't think that this is about change, it's about enrichment.
Yeah, but I mean, enrichment is change, so why
Fair
not?
Enough.
I mean, it's a change for the better. This is a constructive change. This is a constructive friction we have to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, if the intent is to get hold of the smartest people, and like I say, if intelligence is equally distributed, yeah, then we just have to make sure that we make an environment that can, in fact, attract and keep the best heads. It's as simple as that.
So basically, if I would paraphrase that, that would be, because for me, empowerment is building on something. And here, what I take away from this conversation is, before you even think about empowerment, level out the playing field. Because maybe it's not equal, and there is no point in empowering if the game is skewed against you, right? It won't work. Or in the best case, it will be much more expensive to empower you on the playing field where you are at a disadvantage for like whatever reason you have no control over.
For me, empowerment would be being given a position and a possibility to interact in a change in some other direction. And like you say, if the playing field is not level and I'm not given that opportunity, okay, then my talent or whatever I know will go to waste. But I have to, again, like I was talking about teams earlier, this respect piece, trust and respect are very, very important. You're kind of like opening up a whole box of worms here. We're in the gender equality thing. I mean, I'm Norwegian, so I think I'm in that context of pretty lucky because, I mean, we're not quite there yet, but we are pretty far along the road. When I joined the armed forces, we had no female conscripts. Now we have equality in that terms. So both male and females are drawn into conscription. There's no difference. I mean, try to pull 50-50. And I think that's pretty enriching. I think we're getting a whole lot of new good brains that can be very, very constructive.
I understand that you are out of the force for some time, but this process started happening while you were still there, right?
Yeah.
What were the changes that you noticed, whatever you could observe there?
What I'll say is that you had to reach a certain critical mass to start getting this understanding and getting enough thoughts. My kind of take on the situation, what happened, and I'll have to say it's kind of my view into what happened. But the first females we had coming in tried to be men, and I think that was the case for quite a while. And at some point in time, they became a critical mass, and then they could start showing the other side of themselves. And again, don't misunderstand me. I mean, we talk about male and female as two completely different things. I mean, most of us know that masculinity and femininity are a scale. So you will find females that are more masculine. You will find males that are more feminine. And in fact, most of us are pretty much somewhere around the middle if you look at the extremes. But I think also in terms of, for example, getting up the critical mass within the officers, it was very, very important to have some females that could be role figures, that we started getting enough of them so that other people will want to follow. That takes some time. I mean, I spent, as I said, some 28 years in the armed forces. The first female conscripts we had in the Navy, they came in as I was a young sergeant. 28 years later, we even had a female submarine skipper. So there's been an enormous movement in obviously thinking and using the kind of resources that are out there in society in terms of brain power or motivation in the population.
There's one topic that you mentioned before, and I would like to return to it, which is emotions and dealing with emotions. So like you mentioned that for the team to function well, it's important to share emotions. And it's generally known that women are more emotional than men. So how does this work in a professional setting in the army?
I don't know if I quite agree that there's a general rule that women are more emotional than men. I think maybe some of this has to do with how we're trained to deal with our emotions. So it's more about, you know, kind of bottling up whatever. And this comes back to what I was talking about early on today, this thing about respect and trust and so on, and conserving energy. It doesn't matter for me if you are male or female. Let's say you're going through some other kind of life crisis. If you try to bottle that up and keep that away from the team so they don't know what's going on, point one, you'll be using a lot of energy to kind of hide, conceal the fact that you're going through some other problem. And the second thing is, of course, that the team will start noticing that you're not producing like you're supposed to. You might even be criticized, and maybe even totally unnecessary. If they knew what was going on, they might have been able to help you. And I don't really think that there is that big a difference in the emotional. Like I say, most of us on a male-female scale are somewhere around the middle. So I don't really believe that that's... It's maybe more thing we want to believe in more mm-hmm. than a reality.
Okay, so if you get your civilian teams these days, how do you convince them to share their emotions and to be vulnerable of each other?
It's difficult. It's very difficult. Like I say, you don't have the luxury of keeping people together over a long time, night and day, pushing them, making them accept the fact that they have to share. Because, I mean, in the end, that's what happens. You find that you cannot be an island on your own. So it's a lot more difficult. But yeah, you can at least try by opening up for discussions. As a leader, I think you can do a lot by opening up yourself and showing your vulnerabilities. Because if the leader is very closed, I mean, everybody else will be closed. It's as simple as that. If the leader opens up, other people might open up because they can see that's acceptable, especially if you explain why. You don't just tell somebody something. You explain kind of group dynamics, you explain why it's important to share, and you start sharing the stuff that people maybe should know about so that they can understand where you're coming from, maybe what you're dealing with.
So this is one strategy. Is there any other strategy that you would recommend to the leaders to apply for their teams to make them better teams?
Again, depending on what kind of environment you are in, friendly competition can be a very good tool. Giving people time, but again, we're back to the luxury the civilian life doesn't always have.
Doesn't want to give.
Or doesn't want to give, yeah. I think you have to see the team, read them to find out what they need. Leadership is kind of an art. For me, there's a big difference between leadership and management. Leadership has all to do with making people feel they belong together and be a unit. Management is pretty much going through the motions, doing things right. So I think any leader should have at least three qualities. To have some kind of knowledge of strategy, that is where you want to go. You have to have some other notion of leadership, which is kind of like making people belong together and taking care of each other. And then you have to have the management part, which is doing things correctly or efficiently. So for me, those three elements belong in what I would call command. So I put a big C around the S, the L, and the M. And then, of course, I mean, I have to look to the next level. Why am I put together as a team? What mission am I trying to solve? What is the intent for my unit? And then I use my strategy to find out what is the best way to do this. I use my leadership to kind of motivate. And I use my management to kind of push through the plan I've made through my strategy.
If you were to recommend a book every leader should read, what would it be?
I would say The Art of Action by Stephen Bungay. That would be a must for me. There are many books that are musts, no doubt about it. But I would say I very much enjoyed that book and Stephen's approach to leadership. But it might be, of course, that it was like reading what I grew up with. I found a lot of things there that, and I said, you know, I've been through that. I've been through that. I understand that. So that would be at least a book you could read to kind of understand leadership in a military context.
I remember having read the book that you recommended me, and it's called It's Your Ship.
Oh, it's another very good book too, yeah. I think the really good part about that book is maybe, in fact, the empowerment part.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking I read that book.
But also this rebellion. I loved in this book how he goes his own way and he pulls his team not only because he has good ideas, but also because he has the guts to stand up to the system.
No doubt about it. He was a very brave officer in that context. I mean, I'm glad to say he was a Navy guy. So I'd hope this is kind of like a Navy trait. We do have a friendly kind of competition going on with both the Air Force and the Armed Forces. There are differences in how we think. But in my view, the book describes what an officer should do. What it showed was that the upper echelons, in fact, gave him the possibility to do things his way. And because he all the time was proving through action, through, in fact, what his team or his crew were doing, this was a good approach to that specific ship with that specific crew. So I think it just shows understanding the context you are in and trying to make the best of it. And I mean, if he had been on a different ship with different people, it might not have worked.
Basically, where I see the value of this book for business world, because quite often, at least in Poland, people say, you know, I understand that it works somewhere else, but you know, my situation is special and it won't work here. And that book, in my eyes, is a lot about empowerment, actually, and kind of delegating the decisions and the power down the chain of command. And then my takeaways from this for those reluctant business leaders, managers, the punchline for me, look, if it works in the military, which is highly structured organization, at least that's the perception that, we, the non-military
civilians,
people, civilians have, it is not impossible that it won't work for you.
The funny thing when you ask that question is that you'll see the following. If you're on the outside and somebody says, we have this great idea from the military, they will say it doesn't work because it only works in that context. But it's the same the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you have a brilliant idea on the outside and you say, we want to try that in here, it won't work. I'll tell you a strange story. I once upon a time tried to convince some of my officers to try and implement the thoughts of the ISO 9000 and 9001. Because I thought it was a pretty good idea on the outside. And they said, you know what? Oh, that won't work. That only works in a civilian. And then I started reading, and then I found out the following. The entire ISO system came from the military.
Oops. Jokes
so what,
on them.
What you had there was all of a sudden a situation where a body of knowledge and its concept was derived within a system. It was then embraced, pushed on the outside, and accepted there, and then they couldn't retransfers back again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think you have the same way around. Okay, it's your ship. It was a different way of thinking that was on the outside. And he tried to bring it in, and it was very, very difficult. I'm pretty sure, since you're saying this, this book, it describes what happens in the armed forces. Well, think about it.
Yeah.
It was somebody who pulled the idea the other way around. So why shouldn't it work on the outside?
Yeah. That's a very good point.
So I see a lot of this. I mean, you kind of like you say, you're saying, it won't work here. And we're full of that. Instead of listening, trying to find out, okay, what can we use from it? You won't be able to use it all. It's not a blueprint. It's something you have to retune to whatever you're doing. But I'm pretty sure there are lots of good ideas on both sides of the fence. And it's pretty sad if we don't utilize the possibilities that are there.
Peter, if you were to say what your mission in life is, what would you say?
Well, I'll try to have as much fun as possible. I think I'll try to learn as much as possible. But do I have a life mission as such? The beacon I'm going to leave after I'm gone? If I can do something that is kind of like make other people think, challenge the status quo. Understand that we don't know everything. And unless we discuss and are open, I think we're missing out on some great opportunities. So I'll try and teach people whatever I can. I'll give them my peace of mind. I sit here sounding like I know it all. But you know what? I only know a small part of it. I only have a set of experiences. And this forms whatever I say. But I think if I don't tell people what I know, what I think, how I kind of reason, well, then I might leave someone short because they could have used something I used. As a young man, I read a book called From Creation to Chaos. It was a collection of scientific essays. And there was one story there. I can't remember what it was called, but I do remember the main message. What they said was the following. When a president is on the podium and says something important, this didn't happen in a vacuum. Somebody said something to him along the way that made him start thinking in that direction. And I think that's the point. I mean, every day we have the opportunity to influence people to become better, to come with brilliant ideas, hopefully a lot more brilliant than our ideas today. Empower them. So by being out there and really trying to just taking the chance on telling people what you think, what you believe, discussing, I think that might help some brilliant minds someday to get somewhere.
Thank you so very much for your time and for your insights. It was fantastic having you here,
Peter. A pleasure to worry. What the audience doesn't know, of course, is that we've known each other for a while, and I really do appreciate a lot of the room and space we have to have these kind of discussions we were just talking about. Kind of openly and freely discussing different things without bias, being able to throw ideas out there and test them. And some of them are good, and some of them are not that good.
And that's okay.
That's okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We would love to hear from you on Twitter at Malka6 and at DLS6. You can find more details on www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com. We are having a hungry cat here.
Yeah. Another Norwegian discussing.
Another Norwegian
with us.
Yeah.